George Bugs dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. George Buck is dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread.
This is part two of the radio adaptation of A Great American Tapestry, a five-part audio documentary based on the film of the same name. I'm David Weintraub, the director and producer. This program is a production of the Center for Cultural Preservation, based in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and WNCW Radio. It's based on the film A Great American Tapestry, The Many Strands of Mountain Music, which is currently touring the region and is available on DVD with more information at saveculture.org. The film was made possible in part by Paul and Simone Shoemaker, Carola and Stuart Cohn, the Perry and Rudnick Endowment Fund, Jim and Barbara Neal, Helen Bishop, and Adept Word Management. No instrument exemplifies the major influence of African-American culture on American music than the banjo, a West African instrument that came over to America with the slaves. C.C. Conway, author, filmmaker, and Appalachian history professor at UNC Chapel Hill and App State University, starts us off.
About the year 2000, new research began to come to us from West Africa, from Senegambia, and particularly Southern Gambia. A long spike neck lute, the first one we saw was the Akonting, began to look more like our early gourd banjos in this country. The gourd banjo arrived with blacks in the colonies no later than 1740 in Maryland. And the descriptions of the early gourd banjo and the first picture in 1792 of a banjo all suggest that these long spike neck banjos, now there are about five traditions that have been noticed by people who didn't grow up with them, seem to have been the physical influence of our earliest gourd banjos and to have provided us with drop thumb clawhammer banjo playing.
Justin Robinson is one of the founding members of the original Carolina Chocolate Drops. He has been studying black music influences for years.
So the banjo comes from what is now Senegal and Gambia and parts north. People still play it's, you know, it's antecedent today. If you do a couple little modern things to their instrument, the Akonting, you get the sound that sounds exactly like clawhammer banjo.
What some people forget, and history buffs often miss, is that many of the original slaves who came to this country were brought here for their expertise in farming and other skilled labor that southern plantation owners needed.
When this country was being, the United States is being founded, folks were being brought over to do skilled labor. The other narrative is that folks were just coming over to hoe cotton fields and whatever. That was much later. In the beginning, folks were coming over as skilled labor. They were bringing blacksmiths, and they were bringing horsemen, and they were bringing rice growers, and they were bringing all kinds of other things. Metal workers, dyers, people who know how to work with indigo. All that stuff people were doing in Africa beforehand. And the banjo's antecedent, the Akonting, is a farmer's instrument. It is a workaday instrument. It's not a classical music instrument like the ngoni or the kora or those anything. So these people were brought over because of their rice farming expertise, and with them would have come this instrument. The instrument comes from that region, so does the rice, so do the people.
So why then has the banjo been such a perplexing part of American musical history? Rhiannon Giddens, one of the premier banjo performers and Grammy Award-winning co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, adds her insight.
The journey of the banjo is so interesting and is so hidden in American culture. You know, you don't have the banjo until you have a lot of people from different parts of, you know, primarily West Africa, being brought over to North America, particularly to the Caribbean, which is where, you know, people who were going to be sold into slavery were seasoned, especially if they were going to end up going up to North America. So much of what becomes African-American music and dance is formed, you know, in the Caribbean, in Congo Square, in New Orleans, where all of these different cultures didn't speak the same language, weren't playing the same instruments, but were playing in a sort of family of instruments, of these lute type instruments, you know, either the memory brought over or the instruments themselves brought over. And then, you know, the syncretization of all of that, forming what becomes known as the banjo, the banjar, the banjur, whatever, banza, bonza, in the Caribbean, and then being brought with people up to the southern United States, or actually just the United States in general, you know, because people forget that there were enslaved people all over.
Put on a skillet, put on a lid.
Few people realize that the banjo was not played by white people for nearly 100 years after its arrival on our shores. Here's Cece Conway.
We do know that the banjo, the gourd banjo brought by Africans, arrived in Maryland no later than 1740. In about the 1830s, a few white people began to take an interest in the banjo, like Joel Sweeney, who was from Appomattox, Virginia, and probably learned from neighbor slaves. And a man named Ferguson joined a circus, and Dan Emmett learned to play banjo from him. He was a white man, but he had obviously learned from blacks. The point is, there was no one to learn from except blacks. Sweeney was very proud of his banjo, and by, I think it was 1842, the minstrelsy had begun taking off already. Sweeney became part of it with the Virginia minstrels, and they may have been the first band to have a fiddle and banjo together.
Although not the founder of the minstrelsy, Sweeney was one of the first big names associated with the blackface minstrel movement taking off. Four-time Grammy Award-winning musician and music preservationist David Holt picks up the story from there.
Joel Sweeney was one of the first. Learned to play the old clawhammer style from the black plantation workers and began to teach it to white people. People like Dan Emmett and people who wrote, I mean, he's the guy that wrote Dixie, and he was a northerner. These were northern people. These were not southerners. And so that was the very first time that black influence came into the American music. And it was just this incredible big bang, I think, of that's affected our music from that day to this.
My love, I plan to leave you while the river's running high, but I never can deceive you, so don't you.
These were fretless banjos, so you could really slide around like the fiddle was sliding around, and just get some bluesy, funky sounds that, you know, just sort of revolutionized the fiddle tunes, which had been probably a little more stately till then. If you listen to Scottish music, it's not as hard driving. So the banjo, which was a black instrument, and the banjo rhythm, which was a black rhythm, integrated with the fiddle tunes, these old Scotch-Irish fiddle tunes. And it was rocking, man. I mean, you go to a place like Mount Airy and you hear the tunes, they're simplified. There's not as many notes as some of the tunes from Europe, but they have a drive that's undeniably American.
Roots musician Dom Flemons discusses the history further.
They were white men most of the time, and they were trying to cash in on the power of black music, essentially. And they would black their faces up, and they would do comedy bits that would lampoon black people. And so that was it's a very hard part of the history. But it led to the first American popular music to be spread all over the nation.
So blackface entertainers start taking the banjo, and people go nuts. They're like, what is this thing? This is amazing, you know, and it becomes this cultural explosion. Like they travel to Europe and Australia and South Africa, and it's the whole world's first encounter with indigenous American music, even done through white people playing in blackface.
The whitewashing of the history of the African banjo, shrouded in the haze of the minstrelsy performances, brings us to today, where little is known of its true history. Justin Robinson continues.
It starts to become associated slowly, with white folks. So this is, it starts off as pure cultural appropriation. And then later, the appropriation is and transformation is so complete that it seems as if black folks have never had anything to do with the instrument.
But the minstrel shows did not only have a white audience. A growing black audience took hold. In addition, black performers began to change the genre. Warren Wilson College Appalachian history professor Phil Jamison continues.
Pretty early on, the white performers would sort of outdo themselves as being trying to be the authentic interpreters of black music. And at some point, black musicians said, wait a minute, we are the authentic ones. Why aren't we up there? And this was really the first opportunity for black performers on stage. What's interesting, though, is that the black performers put on blackface, blacken their faces as well, and basically reenacted the same shtick that the white performers had created.
So then you start having actual African Americans going into minstrelsy, and that's the only way they can, you know, be performers is to do minstrel music. So they're putting on blackface on their black faces, and then it starts to subvert, you know, because the only way to survive doing that sort of thing is to subvert it, you know, and so that starts to happen, and unique, you know, African-American humor, you know, starts twisting blackface, and then you start having people going, why are white people still performing in blackface when there's black people who can actually do that, you know?
So you have white folks imitating black folks for whatever reason, and then you have black folks imitating white folks imitating black folks. It gets crazy real fast.
The minstrel shows themselves didn't come into the mountains, since they usually consisted of large orchestras that couldn't traverse the mountain's rough terrain. However, a derivation of the minstrelsy did. David Holt picks up the story from there.
They took a lot of these minstrel show songs, put them in a little show with a doctor selling medicine and one entertainer or two entertainers, and they would go way back in the mountains. And that's where a lot of these songs like Lost John, these definitely bluesy kind of songs, that's how they got into the mountains through those minstrel shows. And guys like Uncle Dave Macon, Roy Acuff, you know, the McGee brothers, they were all worked in the medicine shows and spread that music all around through the mountains.
Tune in tomorrow for part 3 of the radio adaptation of The Great American Tapestry, focusing on how records and radio changed the music forever.
George Buck's dead, last word said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. Don't you put no shortening in my bread, now, now. Don't put no shortening in my bread.
This program was produced for WNCW by Kim Clark.